Si tienes ciertas afecciones crónicas como
enfermedad cardíaca,
asma,
diabetes, y tienes 19 años o más,
52,
36,
42,
puedes estar en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico acerca de vacunarte con Prevnar 20, vacuna conjugada antineumocócica 20 valente, una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones contra 20 cepas de la bacteria que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. El efecto secundario más reportado fue dolor en el área de la inyección. Para más efectos secundarios comunes e información completa de prescripción, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20. Si tienes ciertas afecciones crónicas como
enfermedad cardíaca,
asma,
diabetes,
y tienes 19 años o más,
52,
36,
42.
Puedes estar en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico acerca de vacunarte con Prevnar 20, vacuna conjugada antineumocócica 20 valente, una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones contra 20 cepas de la bacteria que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. El efecto secundario más reportado fue dolor en el área de la inyección. Para más efectos secundarios comunes e información completa de prescripción, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, June 28th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into this week's episode, I do want to thank those of you who support the show. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's because of the generous support from listeners just like you. If you would like to pledge on an episodic basis, all you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy. This week's top patrons include Mary Neva, Rob Schreck. Oh, real quick, thank you, Mary. You wrote me the sweetest message, and I promise I'm going to get back to you, but I just want to let everybody know that Mary is amazing. And of course, welcome back, Rob Schreck. I also want to thank Pasquale Gelati, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Ulrika Hagman, Elise Christie, Robert Christ, and everyone else who makes the show so very special. All right, we have a great episode for you this week. I am so excited to be sharing with you a conversation that I had with my good friend, Dr. Brad McKay. Brad is actually a GP, he's going to say that during the show, a general practitioner is what they call them in Australia, a physician, and he's also a science communicator, and he has a brand new book out where he exposes all of the potential dangers of wellness warriors, anti-vaxxers, fad diets, dodgy supplements, alternative practitioners, and conspiracy theories. The book is called Fake Medicine, Exposing the Wellness Crazes, Cons, and Quacks Costing Us Our Health. So without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Brad McKay. What? Oh, Brad, I'm so excited to be talking to you today.
It's so great to hear your voice and not just listen to your podcasts, Cara. So.
It's been too long. Okay, so tell me, the last time we saw each other was just before the pandemic, yeah?
Yeah, it was at a skeptical conference in Melbourne. And just before everything hit the fan, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, I think it was like November or December or something. I remember I had a really bad cold, not COVID, but a really bad cold. And you were kind enough to navigate the Australian pharmacy system with me. I was very confused.
We went on a pharmacy tour of Melbourne, which was always fun.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. And you don't live in Melbourne, right? You were coming in from Sydney?
Yeah, so I used to live in Melbourne. So I lived there when I was a teenager. I went through uni there and then moved to Sydney about 6 or so years ago. So I know Melbourne well. I know that it's very cold. I know that they have good coffee. And I know where the pharmacies are, which was your benefit.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, always good to have doctor friends in all the places where you need them.
Of course, of course.
I have to say, I'm so excited to talk about your new book. It came out recently, Fake Medicine, Exposing the Wellness Crazes, Cons, and Quacks Costing Us Our Health. This is such, I mean, talk about timely. Talk about important.
No.
Right? But
this is the weird thing. So when I saw you last, I was in Melbourne and I was pitching the idea to a publisher down in Melbourne. And so I was saying, oh, look, everything's sort of getting a little bit out of hand with all of the misinformation that's around. Like we're just seeing a lot of sort of Instagram influencers who are getting on board and telling everyone to have turmeric smoothies to get rid of their arthritis. Yeah, we really need to be getting control of this and yeah, do something about it. And she thought that there was enough there to sort of like get a book going. And then like less than a month later, COVID hit and the amount of misinformation just went bananas. So it's sort of, I had to keep on updating the book all year as I was writing it. With all of the weird conspiracies that were happening with COVID, but also with all the strange things that some Australians were doing to try to offer cures or trying to spread weird rumors about where it came from.
Right. And the funny thing is, and maybe it's because we live in a very globally connected world. Maybe it's because ultimately American, British, Australian, South African culture has these colonial roots and it really comes from a very similar kind of mentality, this Western mentality. Or maybe it's because of like convergent evolution, you know, that these things would just crop up naturally all over the globe. But the things that you talk about being relevant, the kind of the fake medicine, the bad medicine, the pseudoscience, the charlatanism in Australia is like the exact same as it is here.
Look, we blame America. So everything everything that comes out, it seems to just originate from America. And the internet just spreads it. It's a viral infection around the world of misinformation.
Okay, fine. We'll take it. And I love the way that you sort of formatted your book, because not only do you talk about your own personal journey, your journey, through navigating faith early on, your journey through navigating some of the pressures and responsibilities, and beyond that, the prejudices that you have faced within the LGBTQI community. But then you also do an amazing job of literally just like parsing and drilling down into all these different types of pseudoscience that come across your desk as a physician, that the types of pseudoscience that your patients, for example, often fall victim to.
Yeah, well, I was sort of inspired by working as a GP, a general practitioner, or a family practitioner. It's a little bit different in Australia compared to the States. But I just sort of came across all sorts of weird and wacky things across my desk that I really didn't see when I was working in the hospital. You sort of go from this environment where you're academic, you're studying medicine, then you move to the hospital and everything's sort of like by the book. And then you go into general practice and then somebody comes in and their thyroid function is all over the place. And they're telling you that they don't want to be put on like that synthetic stuff that that you could be giving them or prescribing them. And then they end up telling you that they're having like biological thyroid supplements. And then when you actually like look it up on Google and search it with your patient online, you find out that, it's biological thyroid extract. But it's little known to the patient. It's made from ground up cows and pigs' thyroids. And so no wonder their thyroid function is just all over the place, because they're not having a standardized dose. They're just taking like random capsules depending on how good or how bad that pig's thyroid function was at the time it was killed. And so this is just sort of like the random stuff that just sort of pops up. And a lot of people just believe it. They believe that medicine is evil. And I suppose part of the book and writing it was to sort of show a little bit of my character and who I am and talk about a few of the journeys that I've been through in medicine and being a patient. And yeah, just trying to have a bit of a human face to what people will often say is big pharma or big medicine. And as you're saying, like just trying to cut through those messages and talk really plainly.
Yeah, I think it's so important to talk really plainly and like make the information available in a way that is digestible, that is understandable, and that is really clear and to the point. Because I think a lot of times, part of the reason that pseudoscience, that fake medicine is so sexy is its simplicity. Part of the reason that it resonates is because oftentimes it is propagandized in a way that feels intuitive. And sometimes medicine feels counterintuitive. And so to be able to speak in a very plain way, a way that many doctors unfortunately don't always speak, is fundamentally important. And so on the one hand, like, A, I think you do such a beautiful job of doing that in this book. Like, you can read it and go, oh, okay, that's why.
He's crazy. Yeah, but that's fine.
Like, I get it.
Oh, that's part of it as well. Like, part of writing the book was also fighting against my own instincts. So, like, I wrote the book and I got about to September of 2020. And then I showed it to my partner, who's a producer. And he just, like, read the book and said, well, Brad, you've written a very good textbook, but no one's going to read it. So, so he like really cut me down. And so then I had like a couple of months to sort of like just rewrite the whole thing and spend a lot of Christmas 2020 just sort of like buckling down and trying to rewrite everything and trying to put those personal touches into it. And this is what we find on, as you're saying, it's sort of appealing from an Instagram perspective. We sort of like tend to be drawn towards these stories, these anecdotes where people just sort of like tell you a story and then we just like by osmosis, we take on their messages. And so it's sort of like getting you on side. So I suppose it's surreptitiously getting people on side. That's probably the subtext of fake medicine. Just sort of get under your skin, make me appear really, really nice and lovely, and then kick you in the teeth later on and say, look, acupuncture, you're probably not going to do anything to your health. So it's that's my underhanded plan.
I love it, though, because, you know, I think what's so important and what's often missing in this sort of skeptic community that you and I both know so well, and I think probably a fair amount of the listeners of Talk Nerdy might identify as skeptics or might feel like they're aware of the skeptic community because they know me through SGU or they know me through some of my earlier work in the skeptic community. But there's also probably a bunch of people who listen to Talk Nerdy who are like, what is this skeptic thing you keep talking about? I don't get it. It sounds like a bunch of cranky old white men and everybody's grumpy and why is everybody always talking down to me? And I think that that's unfortunately one of the, especially in the US, I mean, I can't really speak to the Australian skeptic community as much because every time I've been lucky enough to visit Australia and speak at a skeptic conference, I'm like, oh my God, I love you people. I love it here. But especially in the US, I think one of the things that we struggle with is the kind of the pompous nature of skepticism. It's the haughtiness. It's the, how could people be so stupid as to fall victim to fake medicine? And that is not serving anybody.
So did I tell you how I got into skepticism in the first place?
I don't think you did.
Oh, like one of my best mates, like I went to high school with him. He's living over in London now. Theodore, if you're listening, hi. He was telling me about like one of his friends who had got, like he started listening to the SGU. This was like more than a decade ago, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And so now at parties, he was a real asshole. Because he kept on telling everyone
that they were, him.
He kept on telling everyone that they were wrong, that they didn't know what they're talking about, and was sort of like emulating that haughtiness. And so I was there going, what the hell is this? Like, how did somebody get converted to assholeism? Like, this is pretty terrible. And so so I started listening to the SGU and to sort of hear what was going on. And that was not the impression that I got at all from it. I just saw like how they were breaking down like science or like looking at debunking different things that were going on and just taking a very rational approach. I think that's something that Steve Novella and the other Novella brothers and yourself do really well. Is just sort of like have that side up to the person approach. Like you're not haughty, you're not sort of saying, oh well, you're an idiot for believing this most of the time. But yeah, and this is sort of like what I talk about in fake medicine is that we need to be like attacking the people who are selling the stuff. Right. Like not attacking the people who are believing it. Like if you're going to your Reiki practitioner and they're telling you how amazing Reiki is and that they can heal you by putting their hands around you and filling you up with Reiki energy and you're believing them, then I really feel for the patient because we're like I've been in that situation. I sort of had back problems when I was a teenager. I went and sort of like did what my GP told me to do, my doctor. Went along to see a physio who put a big heat pack on my back, which really caused lots of pain and nearly burnt me. Then I was sent to see an osteopath who took out an adjusting activator instrument and just hit my back multiple times, trying to sort of like heal my back through pain and through sharp strokes of a horrible plastic stick that he brought out. Yes. And then I just did what I was told. Like I went along every week for about 6 months. This was when I was about 16 years old. And yeah, like I did not get better. And every time I finished with the osteopath, I felt worse. Like my back would literally need to be scraped off the ceiling. I was in so much agony. And it wasn't until like I saw a different osteopath, it was like a locum who came in. And he sort of had one look at me and said, "Oh, look, I don't think I can heal you with my stick. I think you might need to go and get a bone scan." So then I went off and had a medical imaging, had some radionuclear dye put into my veins, and then my sacrum just blew up, it lit up like a Christmas tree. Mm. And so I discovered at that time that I had an osteoblastoma, so a really rare bone tumor growing steadily and pushing on all of the nerves. It's about the size of a walnut in the middle of my sacrum. Right at the base of my spine. And so hitting a tumor that's already painful with a stick doesn't help. I can attest to that. I needed to see a surgeon. And so I had the surgery and I had that done and was in hospital for about 6 days and took a little bit of time to recover. And that was when I was sort of accepted into medicine and started studying medicine.
Wow.
So at the age of 17, which is really weird in Australia as well.
Yeah, that's so different than it is here. you start your medical practice from the time you start university.
Yeah, so it's an undergraduate course, so you went straight into medicine. But that was also like preceded by my family, like a very religious family, sort of sending me off to have prayer sessions at a local church. And like going up to the front of church and like asking for God's spirit to come into your body to heal you of your back pain or heal you of a bone tumor in the attempt of not having to undergo surgery by a pediatric orthopedic specialist. Just like really confusing ideas, like from alternative practices to supplements to then religion. Like it was all like a really confusing mess when I was younger. And so I was sort of like trying to pick that apart a little bit in fake medicine. And trying to sort of highlight how easy it is to go down these strange pathways. Like even when we're studying medicine, like even when we're reasonably intelligent, it is quite convincing and that there is that allure of alternative
absolutely
medicines.
Yeah, and some of these alternative medicines, like we were saying before, the reason that they are so alluring is because they have face validity. Sometimes they don't even have face validity. You're like, how would that work? Like there is no connection between this part of the body and that outcome. But other times they have face validity, especially for people who maybe don't have extensive anatomical or physiological knowledge. And so it makes more sense that X would lead to Y. And it's an easy sales pitch as opposed to the actual truth about our bodies being weird and our bodies sometimes failing us and sometimes horrible things happening that we can't explain or control. And I think one of the things that's so detrimental about even, you know, your specific example, which is such a perfect, sadly, but true allegory for so many other people's experiences with alternative medicine, is that the calculation of what's the harm is a really important one. So not only were you physically being harmed, you had a tumor and you were getting the shit beat out of you, right? You were literally getting something that doesn't help but hurts.
Yeah.
But also your treatment was delayed. And I think that's the other side of that equation, that if we are choosing these alternative treatments in lieu of what we know is evidence-based and what we know works, that, you know, the disease is progressing unchecked.
Yeah, but and I see this all the time in my medical practice as well. I've seen patients who have had problems peeing for a while, and so they've been told to take saw palmetto from their the naturopath. And so they start taking a supplement that really doesn't do anything at all. And then 6 months later, when they really can't pee, then we do a few tests and find out that they've got prostate cancer. And that's probably the reason why. And things have advanced. And this is the issue. Like if we... what's the harm? The harm is that we're often playing catch up, and often disasters walk through our doors as doctors, and it's heartbreaking when you have seen somebody and you know that you could have made a difference 6 months earlier, 12 months earlier, but they haven't seen a Western practitioner, they haven't seen anybody from modern medicine, or they haven't been vaccinated, and they come in with a condition that they didn't need to have. This is heartbreaking for all doctors all around the world when we see this. And so we really need to be increasing that health literacy and, educate people that if they are sitting around like a fluorescent light singing Kumbaya with their family, and sort of like there's this weird device called a biocharger that started to be sold in Australia. It's basically like about six different fluorescent lights that have different, different colors. And it's meant to protect your health. But there was like a former celebrity chef in Australia was sort of selling it on his website and saying that it was helpful against the Wuhan coronavirus. And if you're thinking that your family's going to be protected from a potentially lethal virus by sitting around a fluorescent light, then it doesn't make sense. But you can see how people believe in energy fields, and they believe in magnetism, and there are these sort of phrases that are just sort of thrown out, which sound really believable and really interesting, but there's nothing to it. He was eventually fined by the Therapeutic Goods Administration for a large amount of money, but he's still been selling it in Australia as well. So there's certainly a chapter devoted to him in my book as well.
Oh God, it's so heartbreaking to hear how readily, and this kind of speaks back to what you were talking about when you go to the Reiki practitioner or you go to this guy who's hawking this light therapy, that of course it's not the people who are desperate and vulnerable who are sort of the perpetrators. They're the victims of this scheme, but the perpetrators are making money. They're making money off of people in their most vulnerable state. And to me, there's kind of no greater evil. And that's why I get so fired up about this topic.
Yeah. Well, we're doing some investigation about Reiki. I was looking on sites around the place and seeing what people were up to these days. And I was still shocked. I know I've heard a lot before, but I was still shocked reading some of the stuff that's online. So certainly Reiki is this sort of made up thing where you hold your hands over people and you can actually feel different heat going around your bodies, around your body. And you can probably that's going to be happening just from your own a placebo response. And you have your autonomic nervous system that will probably dilate some of the arteries in different parts of your body. You can sort of feel heat flowing in different areas, but it's not healing energy. It's just your autonomic nervous system or your imagination. People were saying that they could, they could take your money, they can come around to your house, they can sort of put hands around you to heal you from cancer or whatever ails you. But then it's not just that, but you could also do it over the phone and somebody can just do Reiki through remotely. You can just send them an email. And then once they've thought about you for half an hour and performed Reiki on you from a distance, then they can charge your credit card and then they'll send you an email to say that it's all done. This is just bizarre. Reiki by remote it takes a very, very good practitioner to do that from the other side of the world.
And yet they're successful, and yet they continue to have patients, clients, whatever. I mean, I don't feel comfortable calling them patients, but clients, paying customers. And I think probably an important part of the conversation we would be irresponsible if we left it out, because I still want to get to some of these amazing quack medicines that you cover in the book, but more of them, I should say. But before we get there, I think it would be irresponsible of us not to talk about the reason that people do seek this out and why it is that we shouldn't blame the victims in these particular cases.
Yeah, totally. And I suppose I see a select group of people coming into my clinic. I often see people who have been through the ringer. They're desperate and they're coming in to see me because something's gone wrong. But quite often when I'm talking to people, I'll find that they have seen other practitioners before, they've seen medical doctors. And the story that I get time and time again is that they feel dismissed. So, or they feel insulted or belittled. And this is a frequent sort of occurrence. So I think for some people, when they have like vague complaints or undiagnosed conditions, or if they're feeling tired, but all their blood tests are normal, there's a whole range of different conditions that fit into this category. And often if your blood tests are fine, if your MRI is normal, then a lot of doctors will just wash their hands and go, well, nothing's going to kill you. Like, yeah, right. What's wrong with you? But if somebody still feels tired and they know that something's wrong, like deep in their heart, they have that feeling that something's not right, and somebody's telling them that they are right, there is that disconnect. So we do see people like going to see naturopaths. We find that maybe the supplements don't help people all that much, but it can be that therapeutic approach and having this partnership with somebody when they're spending like an hour and sitting down and going through your diet and admitting that there is a problem and saying, okay, let's work at this together. That can be really helpful. Even that sort of can be very therapeutic for people if they're offered that hope. But the problem is if that person doesn't know what they're doing and they're offering false hope, then yeah, you've got comfort. You feel that you're heading on the right direction, but you could be going right down the wrong pathway. What I often say is like, if you're not getting an answer from your doctor, if you're feeling that you're being dismissed, then go and see another doctor. Like there's lots of us around the world. We all have different personalities. We all have different skills. We all have different interests. But like, it's really important to stay within that medical framework because that's where you're going to be getting your answers from. Like if you're going into alternative remedies, alternative therapists, if you're seeing naturopaths, then yeah, like you're really going into a strange realm where you may not be getting appropriate advice. You might feel more comforted. That's okay. That's all right. If you're wanting to find answers for your condition, staying in a medical frame of mind is super important.
Right. And that really comes down to the idea that physicians, doctors are licensed. They are trained in the best available science. They are required to pass specific exams that prove that they've learned what they need to learn. It doesn't mean that they're all going to be amazing. It means that there is a baseline of competency that they've proven, and then they're required to do continuing education throughout their careers. And when we talk about alternative practitioners, none of those regulations apply. None. So somebody can literally wake up one day and say, I'm a healer.
I'm a Reiki practitioner.
Because I decided to be one. Exactly. and yes, there may be people who, you know, within their religion or within their culture were taught certain values and they were passed down from mother to father to mother to father or whatever. There may be people who spent their entire lives curating and developing certain types of cultural or religious practices that hold real value for you. But there are also so many people who just decide that they're going to charge money for quackery, and they can do that because they're outside of the bounds of competency. They're outside of the bounds of regulation. What they do doesn't require a license because it's not real medicine.
But then it's even worse than that because there are also people who have studied at university. They've studied naturopathy for years. They've studied applied kinesiology. And they sort of like pass their exams and they're taught this information that isn't really relevant and isn't really real. But they're taught it with such tenacity. They're sort of like, they're hook, line, and sinker in with information. And then they feel that with that degree, that then they're able to practice. And quite often when it comes down to regulations, when it is supplements, like especially in Australia, what we find is that if you're selling like a chemical that's in a tablet, as long as it doesn't kill you, then yeah, you can sell it. That's fine. If it's considered to be food, oh yeah, that's all right. And you can sort of like bend the rules a little bit. You can have it like tightening your third chakra, and that's what this medication does. It's just like very, very general sort of statements, or it gives you back your bounce. And you're like, what? Am I a kangaroo? What's going on? So yeah, like there are these marketing rules that are in place. But the general premise is that it's basically to make sure that you're not killing anybody. But whether it does you any good is a completely different question.
Right. And we have something similar with the FDA and the way that these things are regulated by the FTC and the FDA here in the US, that if it's a food or a drug, it is required to first be cleared and then to actually be approved. But supplements and vitamins fall within a weird kind of murky in-between category where so long as they put that label that says this is not intended to cure or treat any disease, so long as that label is there, you know, you can market any vitamin, you can market any supplement however you like. You can't sell it the same way you sell a drug. A doctor can't prescribe it for you. You can't fill your prescription with it, but you can absolutely find it on the shelves right next to the legitimate substances in a pharmacy. And it is very hard. I remember going to the pharmacy when I had a sty in my eye several years ago, and this was the first time I'd ever had a sty, but I kind of knew what one was. And I looked in the mirror and I Googled it online and I was like, yep, looks like a sty. And I asked around and my friends were like, yep, think it's a sty. And then I was like, there's probably medicine for this. It hurts. So I go to the pharmacy and I find the eye section and I'm like, sty medicine, sty medicine, sty medicine. And I see two or three bottles and I look up close and they're all homeopathic. And I remember thinking, that's weird. Why isn't there any real sty medicine? And then I did a little bit more research and I realized that there is no medicine for a sty. You just keep it clean and it goes away on your own.
Yeah. Even if you're using antibiotics, like it doesn't help. Like,
it doesn't do anything. That's why there's no medicine for the sty, because it doesn't exist. And so, but that sometimes is one of those things that's so difficult as a patient, is that sometimes there is no treatment, or sometimes your body just has to do what it does.
Well, don't you just rub your grandmother's gold wedding ring on your sty to get rid of
it? Put a tea bag. Put a tea bag on your eye. And that's the thing. I hear people swear by this. I hear people saying, no, you have to put a tea bag on your eye. Trust me, it'll be healed in 3 to 4 days. And I'm like, yeah, because that's about how long it takes for a sty to go away.
Yeah. You healed in that time anyway. Yeah. Like, these are the stories that we tell ourselves as well. Like, one of the stories that I was like trying to put into the book, I sort of adapted it a little bit so I didn't embarrass my friend too much. But we'll call her Siobhan, shall we? That may or may not be her real name. But she was telling me that she, like, when she was a kid, she had a wart on her thumb. And so so when she went over to her elderly Irish grandmother, and her grandmother said, I'll get rid of that wart. And then so she rubbed her gold ring on her wart, which is just gross. Mm-hmm. And then said, yeah, your wart will go. And then she was convinced, like, as an adult, like, she was in her 30s, telling me, okay, yeah, my grandmother got rid of my wart by rubbing a gold ring on it. It was amazing because it went away. And I said to her, oh, like, that's really incredible. Like, how long did it take from actually, like, rubbing the gold ring on your wart to when it went away? She goes, it's probably about 6 months. And like, I was like, what? Like, she was so convinced, like, as an adult, that the story, this correlation versus causation is what we talk about all the time. Like, the 6 month gap was still, like, enough for this magic from her grandmother's ring to work. And these are the stories that we put into our own heads. Like, it's these sort of similarities, these parallels. So these events that we like pattern recognition, we clump them together, and then we think that the supplement is getting rid of my sty, that, yeah, the gold ring is getting rid of my wart. And there may be some sort of, like, myth around it. So we do use sort of gold injections, so soluble gold, for some types of arthritis. It's a bit of an old treatment these days, but for some patients it's useful. So there are these sort of, like, rumors about sort of healing qualities of gold that still sort of, like, go around. And there's this mild plausibility where it could be helpful. But when it really comes down to it, like, the gold that's in your ring is, like, inert. You're not absorbing it into your sty.
Right.
But it's still believable.
Yeah. And I mean, it really does remind me of some of these sort of tales that we tell ourselves and the pattern recognition that we have that has, like you said, almost continued even into our mainstream thinking. So yes, there's the folk medicine that most all of us have some aspect of that, where we have to really challenge our assumptions, like, oh, chicken soup is what's curing my cold, or like, you know, that oh, you don't want to, you know, what is it, like starve a cold and feed a fever, like it's just crazy stuff that like does not apply. But then there are these interesting ideas that you often will hear come up where it's like you said, adults, intelligent, well-read adults are like, don't, oh, you're so stressed all the time, you're going to give yourself an ulcer. And it's like, no, but an ulcer is caused by H. pylori. Like, yeah, we know this to be the case. Or
we have
or
it even associated like, with stress or anxiety.
Right. Or yeah. even this, and yes, of course, that, right, we can exacerbate certain things with certain behavioral problems, with certain psychological concerns. But these core medical understandings that like we've known for decades often escape people's common knowledge because the story around it, the anecdote around it feels more relevant and it feels more real. And I don't know why I'm making this association in my head, but when you mentioned your friend and the wart on her finger and grandma rubbing her ring on it, I'm sitting here thinking, don't touch somebody else's HPV. You know what I mean? I'm like,
yeah, just slap that wart back on your own finger.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm thinking about friends of mine, women who are my age, who, you know, women of my age and slightly older who have struggled with HPV because we just were on the other side of the HPV vaccine. And this idea that there was this, I don't know, I have a dear friend who struggled with HPV who her mother, her mother's mother all had cervical cancer. And you look back and you think, yes, there's probably a genetic component, but you also think grandma probably had HPV and we just didn't know about it then. And yet somehow this tale around grandma is that she was unlucky. And the tale around my friend is that she was promiscuous. And these are very dangerous social cues and social stories that we tell ourselves. And they're all based on incomplete information.
Yeah, yeah. There is this sort of like blame that we attribute to it. And I talk about my own journey as well. Like when I realized that I might be attracted to men, like this was like full on in the church situation. And I was just sort of like so embarrassed by my own sexuality that I was discovering. I didn't know how to tell my parents. I didn't know how to tell my church. And so I just sort of like, yeah, put my head in the sand for a long time and tried not to deal with it. And so when I was getting like illnesses, so when I was getting the pain in my back, like I thought, oh, well, this is God's punishment for being gay. Right. Like there is these sort of like, yeah, thought processes that go along. Like even when I was like, I started feeling really tired when I was getting towards my late teens and my early 20s. And I was just thinking, oh my God, like what is wrong with me? All the blood tests were normal. I was being told by my GP that I might have like glandular fever, or I may have chronic fatigue syndrome. But like deep in the back of my head, I was thinking, oh, well, it's probably because I'm like really depressed or anxious, and it's obviously God punishing me because of my sexuality. Right. So it was a really like difficult time, like going through that. And yeah, being diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome and being sort of, having no real hope with that. Like I think a lot of people with chronic fatigue syndrome feel really lost because we don't really have good treatments for it. You're sort of told, yeah, you'll be tired, you might get better, you might not. Like if you try to exercise, you sort of like fall over with fatigue. Like it's a really like debilitating condition. I ended up like seeing a sleep physician who said that I might have sleep apnea. So then I like started wearing a mouth guard, and that made no difference. And then like eventually, like I finally like saw a different sleep physician who then did like a different sleep study. So it was like a nighttime followed by a daytime sleep study. And then found that I like fell asleep during the daytime within about 4 minutes, multiple times over the day. And then explained that all of these demons that I was seeing, like attacking me in my sleep, I was like feeling like I was being like pressure on my chest, feeling a dark presence in the room. And all of this was like, I was thinking I was being haunted by demons and being possessed. But then I finally got a diagnosis of narcolepsy. And then suddenly the light bulbs came on and I'm like, oh my God, like I'm not possessed by gay demons. This is a document, like well-documented medical condition that I wasn't really taught about at medical school, that a lot of doctors aren't told about. And you end up like having these really strange parasomnias with like sleep paralysis where you wake up and you can't move. There's even like Renaissance paintings where people have painted the feeling that they get when there's like a demon sitting on their chest when they're waking up. Like it was all like, it's so like liberating when you're actually like seeing Renaissance artwork that describes your condition that you think you're possessed. Like it's quite freeing. And I think that's sort of like part of fake medicine as well. Is that freedom that you actually get from science and that understanding of your own body and your ability to do something about it. And that's what I get excited about when I'm with my patients and I hit on a diagnosis, when I can stop them from having a heart attack, when I can, diagnose a cancer early. Like I'm always like jumping up and down when my patients have polyps cut out of their colon because I'm like, oh my God, that could have been a cancer. Like, I get so excited about that sort of stuff. And I think that's where we sort of like lose a little bit of that excitement in science. We dumb it down. We write a textbook like I did originally.
Yeah.
But there is this excitement in science. There is this excitement in finding out about our own health. And we don't need to create demons and angels and have all of these other sort of like curses and telling somebody that they're promiscuous and that's why they've got cervical cancer. Like there's a lot of like weird blaming that goes on. But often when you just pull back the curtain and have a look at the science, like it decreases the stigma. It's quite incredible how attitudes can change when that correct information is presented in front of people.
You're so right. And I think we even see this to this day in, it's so pervasive that even with patients who are, and physicians who are all about the most cutting edge medicine, who are all about looking at evidence-based treatments, as I often see working as a psychotherapist for patients with cancer, is that one of the struggles that I see in the patients that I work with and also in other mental health approaches, so other therapeutic situations, not just in psycho-oncology, is this tendency to self-blame, this tendency I think one of the biggest, hardest things that I often talk about with patients who struggle with depression is this idea that like, so first you have to deal with the depression, which sucks. And then you have to deal with feeling bad about the fact that you have depression. And that's a very common experience. It's like this meta depression of like feeling guilty that you're depressed. And you see this with cancer patients all the time. You see this with patients who have a lot of different disorders. And one of the sad things that I see in alternative medicine and alternative treatments is a tendency to blame the victim, to say, oh, the reason this happened to you is because you didn't do X enough, because you didn't pray hard enough, you didn't practice hard enough, you didn't take the supplements, you didn't exercise enough, you didn't whatever. And it can be so much mental anguish that these poor individuals are facing when they feel like, if only I had blah, maybe I wouldn't be dying. Or if only I had whatever, maybe I wouldn't be in this predicament. And it's heartbreaking. I can't tell you how much of my therapy sessions is just trying to recalibrate and restructure cognitions around, you didn't do anything wrong, and this probably would have happened anyway.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic. When I can, I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun, Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Yeah, I think that's that randomness that happens in life that people don't often comprehend. They sort of like try to pin a reason for it. If they didn't eat enough fresh food, fresh vegetables, have enough green smoothies, then yeah, like they blame themselves for it. I remember when I had this pain in my back, like I was told by people that that the tumor was at the base of my spine because I felt unsupported.
Oh God. Yeah.
That's why
it shows. It chose to grow in your sacrum because you felt unsupported. Sure, that's how medicine works.
Yeah, that was probably just a random like mutation of a gene in a certain bone cell that was in my sacrum, and it just happened to be osteoblastomas, are more common in your vertebra, sacrum, or ribs. So yeah, that's probably more the reason.
Yeah, that seems like a more realistic explanation, and it's sad because that can be. It goes both ways, right? And I think most people only see the empowering side of it. They see well, if I hope, if I pray, if I whatever, that this could mean that I stand a chance, that there's a placebo or a non-specific effect. Like you talked about, just seeing a practitioner can have psychological benefits, but we often don't look at the dark side of that as well. And I remember very specifically working with a patient who ultimately did die. And again, through no fault of this patient's own, this patient had a really debilitating and rare and horrible fast-growing cancer. But I remember the struggle of, but maybe if I think a certain way, I can create an experience in my body that cancer can't grow in. And having to have the really hard conversation of, we do know that there's good evidence and there are good outcomes for having, you know, a lot of social support, for having all of these things, but they do not affect mortality. We know that, of course, having a very negative view and being and having and struggling with depression and having anhedonia and not taking care of ourselves and not getting out of bed and all of these things can hasten. But we also know that the flip side of that in no way will extend. It just doesn't work that way. And the sad thing is our society tells us it does. It tells us that you either beat cancer and you were a survivor or you fell victim to cancer. And you beat it because you fought hard enough and you fell victim because you didn't fight hard enough. And what a fucked up message to give to people.
Oh, it's horrible. Yeah, like treating people as failures if they have died from cancer. It's terrible. One of the cases in Australia that I describe in Fake Medicine is about Jessica Ainscoe. And so this was quite a few years ago in Australia. She was sort of like one of the first people sort of to be an Instagram influencer. She described herself as a wellness warrior. So she trademarked that phrase in Australia.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So she was diagnosed with an epithelioid sarcoma. So it's sort of like a connective tissue cancer. It was in her arm, and so she was advised by her doctors at the time that that she should have her arm cut off, but like not just like her hand, but like actually at the shoulder and sort of cutting into part of her chest to get rid of her whole arm. Like it's quite a horrendous operation, and so she decided that she wouldn't have that operation. She would just fight the cancer by having Gerson therapy, which I don't know if you've come across that so far.
No. I mean, in your book, I did. Yeah, not outside of that.
Yeah, so it's having green smoothies or vegetable smoothies, like even on the hour, every hour over the day. So your whole day is spent juicing. And then it's also followed up with like castor oil or coffee enemas to get rid of all the toxins from the lower part of your bowel.
So you're doing the exact opposite of what every nutritionist, every registered dietitian says you should do while you have cancer, which is make sure that you're getting adequate nutrition.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they're having lots of vitamins, not much fiber.
Right.
But the sad thing is like with her, like she followed this this therapy. I think she found like a practitioner over in Mexico and then was sort of like having guidance. And yeah, like she did all of the things right, according to Gerson therapy. But this is a therapy that's been debunked in the 70s. Like we know it doesn't work, and it just basically fills up people's time while they're dying of cancer. So rather than spending their time like spending time with family and loved ones, which I think is much more important, they're spending their time like pooing out castor oil and coffee granules and like juicing their life away. Like it's pretty terrible.
Oh, and they must be on the toilet 24/7.
Totally. So she was a lovely Instagram influencer. She was teaching everybody how to live healthy by following this diet. And then she died. Like, it's just such a tragic story. And like, she may be alive today if she actually had the surgery to remove the tumor from her shoulder and her arm. So this is sort of like, yeah, part of the battle that we have against the Instagram influencers.
That's heartbreaking.
One of the worst sort of like things, one of the worst sort of like victim blaming stories that I heard happened when I was sort of coming out to a friend. This is a while ago. I was sort of like saying that I thought that I might be gay and talking to one of my sister's friends who was a confidant. Mm-hmm. And she started telling me like, oh, well, you probably shouldn't be gay because that's not what God wants you to do. I'm like, yes, sure. Mm-hmm. Fine. That's lovely. And then she started saying, oh, well, you know, all of the gays get AIDS, don't they? Mm-hmm. You're like, no, I think that's like some people do, but.
And some not gay people. Yeah.
And some not gay people. Yeah, totally. And then she said, oh, well, you know what? Like HIV has been created by God because this is what gay men would like.
What?
And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? And she said, well, look, gay men, they pride themselves on being like young and healthy and fit. And so HIV is a virus that God has created for them to make them sick and die young.
What?
I know. I was like absolutely appalled. And I was like, number one.
She believed this.
She believed it. Yeah, exactly. It was horrendous. I was like absolutely shocked. So this is somebody that I was going to for care, like to disclose my sexuality and ask for support. And then I was being told that like HIV was created by God for like to kill off gay people. It was just horrendous. And so like talking to her, I was like going, you know that it affects heterosexual people too. And it's probably the majority of people with HIV have HIV, are heterosexual. Like this isn't designed for gay people. It's a virus that has evolved to affect the immune system. And yeah, like I don't think that gay men want to die from AIDS. Like it's a horrible, horrible way to go. Now I'm an HIV physician. It's one of my specialties in general practice. Most of my clients, most of my patients have HIV and I keep them well and healthy. They're not cursed by God's virus. This is sort of like this weird victim blaming. And like this is what we were talking about before, where when you sort of like pull back that curtain and look more at the virus and like what, like how it came to be about and look at it from a practical point of view rather than a political point of view or a religious point of view, it really destigmatizes things completely. This is sort of like one of my passions is like educating people and making sure that they don't have these like weird and strange stigmas that they may be withdrawing care from people because they think that they're only to blame themselves for having this horrible condition. We really need like, it's sort of strange, like science can be more empathic and compassionate than religion in many ways. Even from like other alternative practitioners, like science is sort of like the ultimate like empathy where we put all of our judgment aside and just care for that patient who's in front of us. That's what really inspires me to get up out of bed in the morning and care for people.
Oh, I love that. And I think that directly kind of transitions this important conversation back to the beginning. You know, you mentioned in the book, and I really highly recommend that people read up on these different, not just different quack treatments, but different whole quack approaches. Like we mentioned homeopathy, we mentioned naturopathy, and anybody who, you know, has been listening to the show for a while, I recommend going back and listening to Britt Marie Hermes episode so you can do a really deep dive. We did a deep dive into naturopathy and her experience as a naturopathic, you know, practitioner, kind of realizing the error of her ways. And you know, iridology, reflexology, we talked about Reiki, these different approaches, but then also just simply these different, quote, treatments like chelation therapy you see all the time with naturopaths, and these different, like, ear candling, right? Like, just dangerous and, like, kooky and, like, not working approaches. But one of the things that you do well in this book is that you were able to squeeze in, you know, because of when it was published, a conversation about COVID. And I think going back to this victim blaming, going back to this idea of fear and stigma, when we're talking about something as frightening as a global pandemic, where we don't understand its origins very well, where a lot of people are confused about how it's spreading, who's getting it, why are some people dying, why are other people's not, there's all sorts of misinformation and panic, it provides a perfect storm for quackery, for charlatans to take advantage of people, and for that horrific stigma that you were talking about. So I would love to hear some of your insights about, you know, how you've been conceptualizing our approach to COVID, what some of the negative takeaways that you cover in the book, but also what we can be doing now as, I think, you know, educated citizens to kind of move in the right direction.
Sure. So I suppose one of the, like, segues between sort of HIV and COVID is, like, I talk to a lot of people who have survived through the HIV epidemic, and they often say to me, like, that HIV was worse. Mm. Like, HIV for them, in a minority community that is, like, this is in Australia, where nobody really cared.
Because it was the, quote, gay plague at the time.
Yeah, it was, like, known to be the gay cancer. So when people were getting Kaposi's sarcoma, even at the local hospital was a Catholic hospital close to where I work, and they didn't really want to be looking after gay men at the Catholic hospital. So a whole bunch of clinics sort of started up around this public hospital in Australia to cope with this minority group that nobody really wanted to touch. And so it did take a long time of breaking down stigma, and we're still breaking down stigma with HIV. Whereas with COVID, like, it's a little bit more general and anybody can get it. Right. Yeah, like, mainly older people are the risk group. So I suppose we could be stigmatizing against older people, but that's a bit ridiculous. So there is this this impetus to change it. There's a lot of drive, there's a lot of money, and everyone got up and going, like, even within a few weeks or a few months, like, everyone was armed and in action and trying to make a difference against COVID. Whereas, yeah, like, HIV was a lot more sort of, like, subtle and took a lot more time before backing got around it. And even before some countries believed that it existed.
Well, and we still see, you know, we still see municipalities in the United States refusing to offer needle exchanges and we still see stigmatization around, like, evidence-based preventive approaches simply because they are so stigmatized, whether it be the anti-gay rhetoric or whether it be the anti-drug rhetoric. You know, it's like, oh, these are people for whom they don't deserve X, Y, or Z. I mean, it's gross. It's heavily stigmatized still to this day.
Yeah. But, like, in a similar degree, like, some countries have said, oh, well, yeah, like, just let COVID run rampant. And like, whoever dies, dies. So there are, like, differing views. And you sort of see this repeated throughout history with different pandemics that do occur. But yeah, and everyone sort of, like, thinks that it's a hoax to start off with. Like, I talk a fair bit about, like, using the stages of grieving as a bit of a way of describing COVID and our reaction to it as the world. It's not a perfect sort of, like, parallel. But yeah, if you've been working with psychotherapy and with clients, often we will talk about, like, stages of grieving. So, like, often it's denial is the first thing. So if you think that a virus is a hoax and it doesn't really exist, then you don't need to change your behavior. Often we will then go into, like, depression and think, woe is me and don't want to do anything about it. Yeah, maybe just sort of tucked up in bed in isolation and quarantine and bargaining. So yeah, like, let's just sort of sacrifice some people and other people will be fine. Finally you get through to acceptance where you're doing something about it and wearing your mask and getting a vaccine. So at this point in time in Australia, like, it's quite interesting. we're sort of a victim of our own success because we haven't had that many cases of COVID. Like, there's a little bit of an outbreak in Sydney at the moment as I'm speaking. And like, we've got like 21 cases in the whole city.
And the fact that you can say that and you know that, it blows my mind compared to like what we've been dealing with in the US.
Yeah.
It blows my mind.
We get like updates all the time saying, yeah, this person was at like Bundai Junction Shopping Center. And if you went to like the underwear store between 2 and 3 p.m. on a Sunday, then yeah, like you should get a COVID test. Then, like barbecue shops come up as somebody's sort of like gone around town, and you see like as this person has gone from barbecue shop to barbecue shop and then eventually ended up at the meat store, and you're like, yeah, you got a barbecue. That's awesome. So this is like how detailed our contract traces can be in Australia. And we are in a bit of a bubble here. We've had a bubble with New Zealand as well, where flights have been going backwards and forwards, but people have been able to get off the plane and they're free to roam around and then come back again. Whereas if somebody's coming from America into Australia at this point of time, they need to be in quarantine for at least 14 days and have multiple sort of COVID tests over that period of time. So there's not that free travel between countries at all. And we've been able to live in this amazing utopia. But people don't believe that it's a big deal. Like, I even talk to some patients and they just think, oh, look, it's just rubbish. It's just a whole conspiracy that's happening around the world. I'm like, so what do you think you're watching on TV? Like, what do you think has been happening in India and Brazil and in the States? Like,
it's amazing. When you literally will hear Americans, especially back before the transition to the new president, you'd hear Americans literally say, oh no, COVID is a hoax meant to try and get Donald Trump out of office. And you're like, you realize that America is not the globe.
Yeah.
Live in other countries and don't give a shit who our president is. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, yeah. So I got angry with one of my patients, who I know quite well, because he was just talking this garbage and told me that it was just a hoax on TV, that it wasn't anything to worry about. And I was like, you must be kidding. Like, this would have to be the biggest hoax ever. Like, you would have to have billions of people who are all in on this joke. Like, what makes you feel so special that you're not part of the joke? Like, that you're not in the in crowd? Like this does not make any sense whatsoever that you would have, like, billions of people trying to pull the wool over the rest of the world's eyes and, like, shut international travel down and put everyone in quarantine. Like, this just does not make sense.
And also literally die and become a corpse just to prove to you. Like, that's the crazy thing. Like,
exactly.
And I think at this point, most people who have lived in a place where COVID has run rampant know what that means, right? Yeah. Most people living in the States know somebody who lost somebody to COVID, and it's devastating. And I think you see that in Brazil, you see it in India, and you see it in places where the case counts were very, very high. And one of the sort of blessings of being in a place like Australia, or even just being in modern Western culture, for example, is why we see the anti-vaccine movement so robust. I mean, one of the reasons that there's so many anti-vaxxers in wealthy West Coast America, like wealthy young moms in California not wanting to vaccinate their children, is because they've never seen polio and they don't remember it.
Yeah, they're not paralyzed from polio with polio pain syndrome. Yeah. Mm. And saying that measles is just a part of growing up. It's like, yeah, it is if you survived it. Like, it's a very biased view. But I ended up shouting at my patient a little bit in a really nice way, I must address. you're being so rude. For all the, like, I talk to patients who have had family members die overseas. Like, they've had like the generation sort of wiped out from COVID. And it's like so insulting to the people that have died and have had COVID. Like, even long COVID, like, they're still struggling at the moment. And I really, like, honed it into him probably a little bit more than I should have. And then the next week, like, this is really unexpected. But the next week he came in and gave me a bottle of wine and apologized. And then, then last week he got the COVID vaccine. Like, it was just crazy. Like, this does not happen.
That's so great. You hold on to that. Hold on to that feeling you have right now.
Yeah, end of one. Yeah, I got there. Yeah.
And so what do you make of, I've got to ask before we start to kind of close up, because we're over an hour now, but what do you make of of what you see across the big pond, right? Like, as you look here to the States and you see on the news the coverage of what's going on here, and you see that 45% of America is vaccinated, which is, whoa, 45% has had both jabs. That's amazing. We've seen, you know, like, oh my goodness, like science really got into gear and like innovation across the globe in order to have these vaccines available. But then on the flip side of that, okay, in America, yes, there's this, unfortunately, is still a small percentage of people who have been unable to get the vaccine. So I want to make sure that I'm putting that out there. There are people who haven't been able to take off of work. There are people for whom they have medical conditions or for whom there has been logistically, and unfortunately, usually it's because these are low-income people who are already facing things like systemic racism, they have been unable to get jabbed. But the vast majority of people who are not jabbed in America have just chosen not to get jabbed. They have access to the vaccine and they've opted out. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I suppose like from an Australian perspective, from an Australian who's traveled a lot around America as well, like it's sort of like it's odd. We sort of put it in a frame of mind of like putting personal rights above sort of public rights, and like there is this sort of like fierce drive amongst Americans for your own personal liberty and like the right to bear arms, like a lot of rights to do whatever you want to do, and you can't stop me from doing that. Whereas like in Australia, there's a little bit more of a collective community feel. Like people are wanting, like it seems to be, again, this is sweeping generalizations, they seem to be wanting to do the right thing by their neighbor. So like even if they don't want to wear a mask, they'll probably wear a mask because it's the polite thing to do. And they're wanting to protect other people. In Australia, we sort of talk a little bit about like a prisoner mentality or a convict mentality, where like if like as Australia was originally sort of populated by convicts after the Aboriginal population as well. And that was another story, which we won't go into today. But yeah, like people describe it as this prisoner mentality where like everyone's sort of like pulling each other's hair and carrying on. But then when the prison guard comes up and like says something, we all sort of like stand in a line and do what we're told. So and that it seems to be this culture has sort of like permeated as well. So we kind of like to know what the rules are. We want to be told what to do and we want to follow that. If we don't have the appropriate guidance, we're a little bit confused. And this is what we've been finding in Australia as well, is that every state is doing it slightly differently. There are different rules at different times. And yeah, like even rules are going back on themselves as well and being undone. And it is difficult keeping up with that. And I think that creates a lot of confusion. And I think it also creates a little bit of unwillingness to participate over time when things are changed around so much. There's a lot of talk at the moment about sort of vaccine hesitancy in Australia. And like I think in America, like there's a lot of people who are anti-vaxxers who are very hesitant to get vaccinated. In Australia, we just haven't had enough vaccines around. The conversation has shifted to like, oh, well, you should just go out and get your vaccine. But like people haven't had the ability to do it. Like there's still heaps of people that want to get the vaccines, but they haven't had the opportunity. Our stocks are really low in comparison to the States and in comparison to the UK. So we're way behind. We're only at about sort of 3% of the population being fully immunized at the moment. Like it's really, really low, really, really slow. And we've also had like a debate about which vaccine to get. So so one of the vaccines, the AstraZeneca vaccine, has been associated with like a rare thrombosis and thrombocytopenia syndrome. And so a lot of people have been really scared to have that. They're too worried about getting the vaccine. It's not that they don't want to be protected against COVID. It's not that they're anti-vaxxers. It's just that they are worried about having a potentially deadly clot. So this has been a big issue. And so the government has sort of been trying to sort of victim blame again by saying, oh, well, you should just go out and get vaccinated. But if people are too frightened to get vaccinated and they're waiting for a better vaccine to come along, that's really creating our vaccine hesitancy at the moment. Not the pure anti-vaxxer, but just people being absolutely cautious and wanting to get a better option.
Yeah, and I think you see a mix of that here. And I also think, you know, you really touched on something when you talked about this idea of the different areas of the country, if they're dealing with different regulations that it can be quite complicated. And that was obviously one of the biggest hurdles here in the States, was that all 50 states were trying to just figure it out for themselves because we didn't have national leadership at the time. You know, we had basically an anti-vaxxer who, you know, in private got vaccinated, but then was like sowing distrust publicly, who was leading the cause. And that was really, and who was pushing fake medicine. Who was pushing hydroxychloroquine, who was pushing literally shining a light inside the body in order to cure COVID. And that's why you see, and I have to say, sitting here in Los Angeles, how lucky I am that Gavin Newsom, our governor, only recently, as of this recording, which we're recording this on June 22nd, recently lifted all of the restrictions in the state because everybody who has had the opportunity to get vaccinated, for the most part, has access to the vaccine. It's in the pharmacies. You can find it very easily. You can get it for free and the government will support you in that. Restrictions are now lifted. Restaurants are back at full capacity, blah, blah, blah. You don't technically have to wear a mask in a lot of places. And I'll tell you what, the other day I was shopping and I was like, I'm going to take my mask off and see what happens. And I did. And I was like, this is weird. And I noticed, I looked around and I was like, wow, 95% of people in the store are still wearing their masks and they don't have to, but they're choosing to because I live in that kind of a community. And I'm proud to have chosen to live in that kind of a community. And I can hear the pride kind of in your voice when you say that that's your home as well. And it really hurts me that the community where I was raised back in Texas does not have that kind of mentality. And I'm not saying all of Texas doesn't, there are definitely pockets, but by and large, it's more of that kind of individualist, my comfort and safety takes priority over global public health. And it bums me out. And I gotta say, I think more like you and like your Australian brothers and sisters. And I think that I'm lucky to live in a part of the country that's like that.
But it is fascinating with that political divide, like that that it is so sort of split politically, that Republicans were more likely not to wear masks and not to believe that COVID existed compared to Democrats. Like it's such that's a bit of a foreign concept in Australia. Like that's significant polar divide between political views.
And I wonder sometimes if that polar divide would have been as extreme if we had had a different kind of Republican in office. If John McCain were the president or Mitt Romney were the president as opposed to Donald Trump.
Yeah, really bad timing, huh?
Right? Yeah. Like, would it have been so polar? Would we have even seen a politicization or would we have seen a lot more working across the aisle? But because Trump himself was sowing distrust, having nothing to do with his politics, as a human being, that's who he was. It happened to be that his party maybe followed more suit. I don't know. We can't know.
In Australia, really early on, our prime minister was saying, oh, look, don't worry about it. It's nothing to worry about. Just still go to the footy. And he was like trolled like through the media, like everyone got on board and said, oh my God, how dare you tell like tens of thousands of people to turn up to the football, not wearing masks, not prepared. We have no idea about this, like unknown mystery virus that's just gone around the world. And like, this is totally irresponsible. And so that was sort of like the last time that he sort of like tried to pretend that it wasn't anything to worry about. So we're very thankful that our leaders did follow the science. But yeah, like we can still complain. There's still like little like nuances. In Australia, we still don't quite agree with our guidelines that COVID is airborne. This is really, really weird. Like all of the doctors are like, yeah, COVID's airborne. Like you can cough it out. I'm pretty sure you can sneeze it out. But our guidelines like haven't quite caught up and it's been 18 months. So we're still waiting for those better masks to be used in those special situations. So we've still got a little bit of way to go, but at least we believe it's a thing.
At least you believe it's a thing. And at least, you know, your leadership doesn't like look at a solar eclipse. I'm just saying, like there are ways to be a leader through example. And
sungazing has other problems. Yes.
That chapter of our history is closed. Thank goodness. Well, gosh, Brad, there's so much good stuff in your book. We barely even scratched the surface, but obviously I don't like to just reiterate the entire book on the show because then people go buy the book. You got to get the book.
No, there's still lots there. There's still lots of interesting things. So people can still buy the book and still get it. So it'll still be available. on Book Depository soon, and Amazon, and it's on Apple Books as well. So it's pretty easy to get a hold of.
Yeah.
But it's not your typical science book. It's a little bit my own autobiography, sort of like snuck in there. And just a lot of COVID hoaxes towards the end, which is the fun cherry on top.
I love it so much. And, you know, before we go, Brad, I was hoping that you could weigh in a little bit. I asked my guests the same two questions at the end of the show. And they're these big picture questions about the future and, you know, who you are in the world, how you grew up, where you are right now. Everybody comes to this with their own unique perspective. And so I was hoping that I could challenge you to give me your perspective as well. Yeah.
Sure.
All right. So when you think about the future and whatever context is relevant to you, I'd love to know, number one, what is the thing that is keeping you up the most at night, the thing you're most concerned about, maybe even pessimistic about or cynical about? And on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely hopeful for? What are you optimistic about? What are you authentically looking forward to?
I'm not kept up at night because I take really good medication to knock me out.
So
that's really helpful. What worries me, I suppose.
We'll say figuratively.
I think that the biggest thing that we're facing as humanity is climate change, because that is going to exacerbate every other problem in the world. So whether it's poverty, whether it's pollution, whether it's people living on Polynesian islands and losing their land and needing to move on, like we're going to have major movement of people. We are going to be having climate change refugees everywhere. It will be a major problem. And I think what disturbs me the most is also like Australia's view of that as well. Like we still don't have great policies to combat climate change. We've just been told this week that the Great Barrier Reef is in desperate need of saving. And our government is saying, how dare these international bodies tell us that we have a problem with our Great Barrier Reef that is heating up in the water because it's too warm and all the coral is dying. This is a political move. It's like, no.
Right.
Like, have you seen the Great Barrier Reef? It has had massive bleaching events multiple times, and it's not getting better, it's getting worse. And our heads are in the sand. We're still getting coal mines being built in Australia. We're looking at gas, like that's our solution, natural gas, rather than investing in solar power and renewable energy. So like, I'm not a scientist in that regard, in physics and in energy. And I suppose that sort of scares me a little bit more. But I do think that we need to, focus more on that being a serious issue and make some serious steps. And likewise, like my optimism is that, like with COVID, with climate change, like I am still optimistic that humanity can come together and that when we do have these global significant problems, like we can put our human brains together and collectively come up with solutions. And that's what I do get excited about, that we have enough caring people on the planet who are smart people, who are fighters, who can convince people of their messages, and that when we do put our brains towards it, humanity can come up with brilliant, wonderful things. That's my hope for the future, is that we can sort of collectively fight COVID and fight climate change rather than each other.
Hear, Brad. Thank you so much for taking the time today. Thank you so much for writing this book, for sharing your story, for sharing these really important, obviously, words of wisdom and educating, you know, just kind of improving that scientific and medical literacy just a little bit more to empower us as medical consumers, as patients, to make good decisions that promote our health and that protect us from being taken advantage of. And thanks for being a friend to me and for hanging out with me and showing me the ways of the Australian pharmacy when I'm sick and just, continuing the good fight.
Thanks for answering all of my Twitter questions, Kara. Thanks for reading it. It's very vulnerable getting my story out, but it's also exciting to sort of like share that and to help people to understand their own health and improving health literacy around the world. Like, that is super important. But you've only got one body. So it's worthwhile knowing as much about it as you can.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you, everyone, for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.